Lecture 14, The Renaissance, Printing, and the Bible.
We turn now from that long period of almost 1,600 years when the Bible reigned supreme as the shaper of imagination and life within both Judaism and Christianity, to the three moments in Western European history that dramatically affected the story of the Bible, in some ways making it more important, in some ways making it less important, and in every respect making it far more controversial than ever. We consider in this presentation the Renaissance and the art of printing and the effect of both on the story of the Bible. Scholars disagree, as they tend to do about virtually everything, concerning when exactly to date the Renaissance, the rebirth of culture in European history. Some finding signs of Renaissance as early as the 12th century, others in the 14th century, but all agree about the importance of the European Renaissance of the 15th and 16th century that began in Italy and spread throughout Europe. It represented both the recovery of a certain kind of learning and, as a result, a change in the view of the world. The two go together. The fall of Constantinople in 1453 obviously meant the loss of the ancient Greek Empire and the triumph of Islam in the form of the Ottoman Empire. But it also meant, to the benefit of the West, a large emigration of scholars and of Arabic and Greek manuscripts to the West, advancing the recovery of a knowledge of Greek language, religion, and philosophy that previous to this point had not been available. Now scholars in the West were able to read not Plato in the Christianized form of Augustine or Aquinas, but the original dialogues of Plato. They were able to read Aristotle not in poor Latin translations of Arabic translations, but rather to read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics in the Greek. And they were able to read as well the Neoplatonic philosophers like Porphyry and Iamblichus. And what they began to discover was how startlingly new and fresh and intelligent and even superior these forms of thought were to what they had imagined. Part of the discovery of Greek antiquity was the discovery that before Christianity, there had been a culture that was in many respects intellectually superior to Christianity. So Plato's dialogues were far more interesting even than the letters of Paul. Such new knowledge challenged the medieval synthesis in a fundamental way. The medieval synthesis had relied upon a unified view of church and state, of philosophy and of theology. It all fitted together and claimed to represent what was there all along. As we saw in our previous lecture, in many ways the world of the medieval world lacked pluralism. And the empirical world and the biblical world could even be regarded as the same, or at least in strong continuity. Now, with the discovery of a culture before Christianity that could be argued to be superior to Christianity, came a sense of history. And with the sense of history, the sense of a possibility of change. The world was not always the way it is now. It once was different, and the way it was then was even better than it became. Greek is better than Latin. Plato is better than the medieval version of Aristotle. And that gives rise to the sense of history, which comes about change in the past, gives rise to the possibility of rebirth and of change in the present. Perhaps the recovery of the past can enable us to reshape the present and the future. So that this recovery of learning led to an altered view of reality, which could be summarized as a much more profound appreciation for the human place in the world. That human existence was worthwhile, not simply as a momentary trial before joining God in heaven, but rather in itself. It was of deep interest. It was of profound significance. The medieval author Bede the Venerable told a parable of human existence in which he compared the transitoriness and the fleetingness of human life to that of a bird who flies from the darkness of the night into a small lighted space, which is a medieval castle, and then very quickly flies out again through the other window. And thus, he said, was the brevity of human life. We don't know where we came from. We're here for a moment, and we're going somewhere better. The view of the Renaissance was to pay attention to where we are now, and this is reflected in the form of art and literature that is called humanistic. We find not an otherworldly concern, but more of a this-worldly concern. In art, we find attention paid to human expression, to the features of the face. The art of Michelangelo, for example, whose dates are 1475 to 1564. Think of the precision and the grandeur of the anatomy found in Michelangelo's David, or the human pathos reflected in his Pietà. A religious theme, to be sure, Mary holding the body of Jesus, and yet it is so profoundly human. It is not iconic. It is not otherworldly, as icons would be. Or Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel. All biblical, but all profoundly human at the same time. There is a sense of possibility and of control within the world that is given by a growth in science and technology. Clearly, the emblematic figure here is Leonardo da Vinci, whose dates are 1452 to 1519, whose voluminous notebooks, written in reverse handwriting, anticipate in so many ways the advances in human anatomy and in science, including the technology, unfortunately, of warfare. In philosophy, figures like Pico della Mirandola, whose dates are 1463 to 1494, tried to synthesize the worldview of Catholicism and the ancient pagan wisdom found not only in Plato, but in Iamblichus and Porphyry. And Pico della Mirandola wrote a work called Oration on the Dignity of Man, a title which would have been unheard of, let us say, having been written by Thomas Aquinas. The issue for Aquinas was the glory of God, not the dignity of humans. And the development of Italian states, such as Florence and Venice, was accompanied by theories of politics that were far removed from the notion of divine rights. In The Prince of Niccolo Machiavelli, whose dates are 1469 to 1527, we find a very hard-nosed, practical approach to the art of politics, not as a matter of what does God will, but how does one gain and use power as a human phenomenon. So the recovery of this ancient learning led to a profound change in the way humans viewed themselves in the world. So the Renaissance gave birth to humanism as a way of focusing upon not the brevity of life, but the beauty of life. And it must be said that as we see in figures like Della Mirandola, this did not represent a rupture with Christianity. Rather, the first effort with the Renaissance was to find a way of combining the recovery of ancient wisdom and Christianity. It was only when we come to the Reformation that we will see the impossibility of holding these entirely together. And then above all, when we come to our third moment, which is that of the Enlightenment, we see that the rupture becomes complete. Let's go back, though, to the Renaissance. And among the technological changes brought about by the Renaissance was the invention of the printing press in Europe, which revolutionized the publication and reading of the Bible. Now, as in so many other matters of science, China had anticipated Europe by the invention of block printing in the 9th century in the publication of the Buddhist tractate, the Diamond Sutra. And in China as well, movable clay type had been used as early as the 11th century, as well as the first iron printing press in 1234. So Europeans in this respect came late to the invention of the printing press. Europeans had used xylography, which was a process of engraving on wood and block printing, by 1423. But it was Johannes Gutenberg, famously, whose dates are 1398 to 1468, who is credited with the fundamental contributions to printing in the West, working in Mainz, Germany. Beginning in 1436, he developed movable metal type, so it involves metallurgy, oil-based inks, molds for casting metal type accurately, and a new kind of printing press. So these are actually four separate technologies that Gutenberg refined. The new form of printing press was based on those used in pressing wines, in the crushing of grapes. It was a matter of turning a very large screw with a handle that lowered a weight that pressed together a sheet of paper or parchment laid over a bed of metal type that had been filled with ink. And then putting that pressure, if you've seen printing done in the period of incunabula, in the very earliest period of printing, you'll see that it is the pressure is actually into the paper. It is almost an imprinting or an engraving in the paper. It was a slow and laborious process, one page at a time. In 1440, Gutenberg mass-produced, ironically, indulgences, those little licenses to indicate that somebody had done a deed that would give them time off from purgatory in the medieval Catholic system, sort of get-out-of-jail-free cards in the game of Monopoly. And he mass-produced those. It was given the role of printing in the Reformation, this is an ironic first effort. In 1444, he printed the Poem of the Last Judgment, and then in 1448, the calendar for the year 1448. These are the oldest extant specimens of printing in the West. Quite understandably, Gutenberg needed a bestseller, and in 1450, he turned his attention to printing the Bible. He published a two-volume version of the Vulgate, the Latin translation of the Bible, in 1455. This is known as the 42-line Bible, obviously because that's the number of lines on each page. Produced 180 copies, of which 45 were on vellum. Remember, vellum was the most expensive material used in the production of manuscripts. So in this and other ways, we find a continuation of the earlier technology as we move into the new technology. Another 135 were on paper. The Bibles were first printed and then illuminated by hand. Color inks, multicolored printing only was invented later. Some 60 complete or partial copies of the Gutenberg Bible remain extant. 11 complete Gutenberg Bibles are extant on vellum. We have one New Testament on vellum, and we have 48 substantially complete copies of the Gutenberg Bible on paper. Understandably, the city of Mainz has two copies. Germany has 12, a total of 12, the country with the largest number. Vatican City and Moscow and Paris also each have 2, London has 3, and New York City has 4. So they're easily available for public viewing. As another example of overlapping technologies, the first printed Bibles resembled manuscripts, so that there wasn't a sense immediately that printing would involve arranging the text in a new fashion. They lacked pagination. There were no page numbers. There was no word spacing. The words ran together in exactly the same way that scribes had done in copying. There was no indentation. There were no paragraph breaks. It was virtually the mass production of a manuscript, is in effect what it was. It may be of some interest to ask then, well, how did these innovations begin to enter into the Bible? Chapter and verse divisions, which we all take for granted. Most of us cite the Bible, if we cite it at all, with reference to a biblical work, its chapter and its verse, were not found in the ancient manuscripts. There were some passage breaks in ancient manuscripts, especially in the Gospels. The 4th century historian Eusebius of Caesarea developed a system by which people could compare passages in the 3 synoptic Gospels that looked alike. So he developed a system of numbering that could be put in the margin of manuscripts called the Eusebian canons to indicate how many Gospels a passage appeared in and which Gospels it appeared in, a primitive system of cross-referencing. But chapter and verse numbers such as we use were first introduced into the Vulgate by Stephen Langton into some Vulgate manuscripts. Remember, all of this was done at random. One manuscript didn't necessarily predict anything for other manuscripts. It was a very much idiosyncratic process. And it was added to some Greek manuscripts by the year 1400. But chapter and verse did not appear in printed versions of the Bible until they were added by Robert Stephanus, or Robert Etienne, who was the head of the Etienne family printers in Paris. It appeared in the New Testament in 1565 and in the Old Testament in 1571. The art of printing was seen to be a very good thing indeed and spread with great rapidity. And it made books and Bibles less and less expensive. And there were several consequences. Just as writing, as we saw, created a more stable text than was possible in an oral tradition, printing now offered at least the theoretical possibility of an absolutely stable and infinitely replicable Bible. Finally, we can nail this thing down once for all. And the authority that had always attached itself to any form of writing now transferred itself to printing even more powerfully. If it is printed, it must be true. This is certainly the position held by my students. If whatever they read in a textbook is superior to anything that I have to say in class, even when I'm the author of the textbook that they're using in class. They delight in showing the contradictions between what I said in the textbook, which certainly must be true, and what I've said orally in class. Secondly, the availability of relatively inexpensive books, and this is a relative term, relatively inexpensive books, to many people meant the possibility of individual ownership. It's not a book that's simply chained in the church. It's a book that I can have on my library shelf. It is now not the possession of the community. It is my possession. So there can be individual ownership of the Bible as a book, and the possibility for the first time for individual interpretation and individual reading. As long as a community has only one manuscript from which a priest reads out loud, the possibility of individual interpretation really does not arise. It is only when one can read the text for oneself that this possibility becomes real. And that happens with the technology of printing. And the ready accessibility of the printed text means that reading the Bible now becomes a phenomenon such as we are familiar with. a visual experience rather than an oral experience. And because it is a visual experience in the form of printing can also make available all of the many tools that are used for the reading of the Bible by individual, the production of concordances, the indices of all biblical words and where they're found in the Bible. In the case of the synoptic gospels, the production of a synopsis or gospel parallels that enable people to read and compare three versions in a way that was simply impossible when the technology of printing was not there. It is impossible to make those kinds of comparisons orally, because you can only hear one at a time. You can do the comparison when you have the visual technology. The invention of printing also combined with the recovery of ancient learning in the Renaissance to stimulate the quest for a better Bible. The availability of manuscripts in the New Testament in Greek had much the same effect on scholars as the Greek writings of Plato. So just as Plato in Greek is better than Plato in Latin, and Aristotle in Greek is better than Aristotle in Latin, surely it must follow that the New Testament in Greek must be superior to the New Testament in the Latin Vulgate, which was the Gospel or the New Testament for the church. So if the Greek was the earliest and original version, as it was, the Latin, however fine, had to be later and secondary. Notice now how the instinct of the Renaissance, which will be carried over to the Reformation, earlier is better than and original is better than what is secondary. The expulsion of Jews from Spain in 1492 also opened up the possibility for conversation between Christian and Jewish humanists concerning the Hebrew text of the Old Testament. So scholars began to make available or to seek to make available a version of the Bible that was more scientific than the Vulgate that was in ordinary use in the church and was the basis of sermons from the pulpit. Now we have the beginnings of a scholar's Bible as something distinct from the church's Bible. And this will be a portentous development that I will try to trace in further lectures. In Spain, Cardinal Jimenez organized a group of scholars at the University of Alcalá, whose Latin name is Complutum, to publish the entire Bible in 6 folio volumes between 1514 and 1522. This became known as the Complutensian Polyglot. Polyglot means in several languages, and Complutensian simply means that it comes from the University of Alcalá in its Latin name. The New Testament in Greek appeared in 1514. That is, it appeared in print in 1514, and the entire Bible appeared in 1522, with the Old Testament having parallel columns of Hebrew, Septuagint, and a Latin written interlinearly, so that now, through these 6 folio volumes, scholars could analyze and compare the original Hebrew with the Latin translation, the original Hebrew with the Greek translation, and approach the scripture analytically in the quest for scientific knowledge. In one of the greatest of the Christian humanists, Erasmus of Rotterdam, whose dates are 1469 to 1536, was a dear friend of Thomas More in England. He opposed Luther's reform program, but was a very sharp critic as well of Catholic corruption, and was a critic of pomposity of every sort. He traveled all over Europe and had gathered together a handful of rather late and somewhat mediocre manuscripts. His earliest manuscript only came from the 10th century. And he produced very quickly an edition of the Greek New Testament together with his own translation, not the Vulgate, but his own translation into classical Latin in 1516. Now, so poor were the manuscripts that Erasmus was working with that he didn't even have a Greek version of the ending of the book of Revelation. So he had to back translate from the Latin into the Greek. So the Greek text of the book of the end of the book of Revelation in Erasmus's version was actually his own words rather than those that had come down from antiquity. Now, the textus receptus, which is a Latin phrase which means the received text and is often abbreviated TR, is the text that underlay the King James Version, and we will talk much more about the King James Version later. That text was based upon the versions of Erasmus and the Complutensian scholars in Spain, as well as the contributions made by the Swiss reformer Theodore Beza, whose dates are 1519 to 1605, as well as the contributions of the printer and editor Robert Stephanus. This Greek text of the New Testament is much celebrated by conservative Christians as having an almost sacred character. But in fact, it is a Greek text that is far inferior to texts that are subsequently produced by scholars. More on that later as well. These developments with respect to printing and the production of Bibles begin a tension within Christianity between the scholar and the priest, between the university and the church, that have never been adequately resolved and continue to be an issue within Christianity up to the present time. In the life of the church, the Vulgate, the traditional version, held sway and corresponded to the Latin that was used in all of the liturgical texts. So in the life of the church, the Latin and all of the ways of worshiping in the Latin text presented a seamless whole, a continuation, if you will, of that biblical world of a medieval Europe. An undereducated clergy that had little Latin and little learning beyond the Latin was capable only of working in this version. And their whole education was geared to handing on what had already been taught. So the tradition of learning within the clergy was to hand on the received truths about Scripture that had come from Augustine and Ambrose and Origen over a millennium earlier. In contrast to this, the scholar in the academy had access to versions of Scripture that were earlier and arguably superior to the one used in the church. The Hebrew and the Greek called into question the absolute authority of the Vulgate, and therefore also the authority of the priest as the interpreter of Scripture. In the university, the point was not wisdom, sapientia, but scientia, knowledge, science. Soon we will see that there would be an increased demand for Scripture to be available through the means of printing in the language of the people, as well as in Latin and Greek. The Renaissance, in sum, was a pivotal period in the story of the Bible. It made possible a new form of learning, a new view of history, and a hunger for change. It made the Bible available in the form of printed books to a much wider population, and it profoundly shook the medieval synthesis based in a scripturally shaped world. And more shaking is to follow.